This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to it.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my guest today Roger Stone, who's a longtime Washington insider who endeared himself to me with his recent book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, with which I completely agree, and now is going further with his new book on the Clintons' War on Women, which he wrote in collaboration with Robert Morrow. Roger, I must say, you're getting pretty deep into the knickers of some of these Washington inside players.
Well, Jim, first of all, let me say I'm delighted to be here with you because you are one of the giants of the JFK assassination research community, and I have enormous respect for your body of work. I've read everything I think you've ever written, and my hat is off to you because you have helped blow the whistle on one of the greatest cover-ups in American history. And I have a book coming out, as you may or may not know, in January called Jeb and the Bush Crime Family. So for those who say, oh, Roger Stone, he's just a partisan hack, he's just a Republican, you know, he's just got the axe out for the Clintons because he's a political hitman. I was a Republican. That was the old Republican Party, the Republican Party of Barry Goldwater, which was a small government party, a party dedicated to the proposition that we should get government out of our bedrooms, out of our businesses, out of our lives. I barely recognize today's Republican Party. It's the Wall Street Party. It's the same party as the Democratic Party, the party of endless war, erosion of civil liberties, massive spending, increased debt and borrowing, high taxes, higher and higher taxes on working people, while we give a pass to the hedge fund managers on Wall Street. So these days I'm a registered member of the Libertarian Party, because I'm a fiscal and an economic conservative, but I'm a social moderate, maybe even a progressive. That's where I think most Americans are, but unfortunately neither one of the parties represents that. So my two books back to back are going to blow the lid off one of the greatest crime syndicates in American history, the Bush-Clinton crime syndicate.
Well, I think that's fantastic, Roger, and I endorse that 100%. In the course of my research on 9/11, I've collaborated with, among others, Richard Hook, who has established that George Herbert Walker Bush was actually supervising a hit team in Dallas on the 22nd of November 1963 in the Dal Techs, from which three shots were fired with a man-licker Carcano by an anti-Castro Cuban, whose name is Nestor Tony Escadro. These were the only unsilenced weapons fired in Dealey Plaza, Roger, to create the acoustical impression that only three shots had been fired. But I've located shooters at six different locations. One was a Dallas deputy sheriff on top of the county records building. Another was an Air Force expert in the vicinity of the triple underpass on the lower left side. Another was a Dallas police officer on the grassy knoll. Another was a mafia mob guy at the intersection of the picket fence and the triple underpass. Another was Lyndon Johnson's personal hitman, Malcolm Mack Wallace, in the book depository, but on the west side, not the east, where he was firing at John Connolly in the mistaken belief that it was Ralph Yarborough. And of course, I've already mentioned the anti-Castro Cuban and the Dow Techs. But there may have been at least one other shooter in the vicinity of their pergola. So none of these were Lee Harvey Oswald, incidentally, where we've been able to establish, based upon research with which you may therefore be familiar, he was actually captured in a famous photograph by James Alchin standing in the doorway of the book depository for which we had a mountain of evidence already based on the height, weight, build, shirt, t-shirt, and so forth of the individual compared to the alternatives, but where we now have a new study by superimposing images. And I'm telling you, when you introduce Lee Oswald into the doorman image, Roger, it's a perfect fit. It's hand in glove. And if you try the alternative, the government claimed Billy Lovelady, he doesn't fit at all.
Yeah, no, I think our views are totally copacetic. As you know, at least six witnesses tell either the FBI or the Dallas Police Department that they see a man who meets the physical description of Wallace in the window on the sixth floor. Heavy set, balding, glasses. That's not Lee Harvey Oswald. Poor Oswald, he's not even on the sixth floor when the shooting goes down. And it is also very, very Lyndon Johnson, who was a control freak, as you know. There's no way he's leaving this whole thing to the mob and the agency. He needs his own shooter at the turkey shoot.
That's right.
Best one. In the convicted murderer, Malcolm Wallace. You know, the cover-up here is just extensive. As you know, Robert Caro wrote now, I think, three volumes on Lyndon Johnson. And they're masterful. They're very interesting. They describe a psychopath, corrupt, evil, power-hungry. But his books never mention Billy Sol Estes. Billy Sol's been airbrushed out of Johnson's history. He doesn't even exist. Go to the index. You know, several people who have praised the Caro books to me said, no, that can't be right. It is right. He covers the Bobby Baker scandal, which is one of Johnson's motivations, because that was catching up with him in the fall of 1963. But the other great one was Sol Estes. These two scandals are about to engulf Lyndon Johnson, not only get him knocked off the ticket, but send him to prison. He knows that Robert Kennedy is gunning for him legally, and therefore it's act or be incarcerated. It is. My hat's off to you. Your work is incredible. I've always believed multiple shooters. JFK is shot from the front and the back. Wallace is only one of the shooters. This past weekend, I was at a conference in New Orleans where I spoke and had a very good reception speaking about my book on Lyndon Johnson and my theory. You know, I think one of the greatest dangers to the JFK assassination community is not the lone nutters. Frankly, they're getting easier and easier to discredit as the mountain of evidence increases that the Warren Commission is an extraordinary cover-up. No, I think the real danger, frankly, is those in the research community who are myopic and only see things from one point of view. No, Stone, you're wrong. It was the CIA and only the CIA. No, Stone, you're wrong. It was the mob and only the mob. No, Stone, it was Texas Oil. The Texas Oil guys did it. You know what? They're all right. They're all right. Each one of them have their own motive. But what is the common spoke? LBJ. Lyndon Johnson controls the CIA's budget. He appoints himself to the subcommittee of the Aerospace Committee, where they tuck the secret black box budgets for the Central Intelligence Agency throughout the 50s. Johnson is also responsible for the massive growth in J. Edgar Hoover's budget when he's the Senate master of the Senate, as Senate Majority Leader. Johnson has a tight relationship with Carlos Marcello. He's being bribed through Jack Halfin to cover the mob's illegal gambling operations in Dallas and Austin and Houston, San Antonio. And of course, he's the water carrier for Big Texas Oil. He's the chief defender of the oil depletion allowance, at least until George Bush comes along. So who is the one guy who has a common relationship with all of the entities, each of whom has their own motive for the killing of JFK? Why, it's good old LBJ.
And who is the one man who would be in the position to control the course of events after the death of JFK, the new president who could determine, make sure that no one would ever be punished for participating in the assassination of his predecessor, which put him into office, which was the plan from Los Angeles when he forced himself on the ticket. JFK had to rescind the only political decision he ever made in his life that was subject to that when he'd invited Stuart Symington to run as his vice presidential candidate. And then when Bobby came by the Johnson suite to make a pro forma office, he jumped on it. and he threatened to expose that JFK had had dalliances with beautiful women who were spies for other nations, that he suffered from Addison's disease, was not expected to live a long, healthy life, and that if he were not on the ticket, then as majority leader, he'd bottle up any legislative proposals coming down from the White House, which would be dead on arrival. Jack and Bobby tried to figure a way out, but they saw none and had to accept Lyndon on the ticket.
Which is exactly why Bobby Baker, on the day of Kennedy's inauguration, a very cold in Washington, Washington day, Baker says to an associate, John Kennedy will not fill out his term and he will die a violent death. You're absolutely right. From the minute LBJ gets on the ticket, the clock is ticking for Jack Kennedy.
That's exactly right. And the point you make about everyone pointing in this direction and that is clarified when you draw a distinction between the sponsors, the individuals and groups who wanted Jack out, the mechanics, the actual shooters on the ground and their supervisors and coordinators, and the facilitators who made the whole thing come to pass, who were Lyndon Johnson in setting up the assassination and J. Edgar, his close personal friend, in covering it up. But where the sponsors include the CIA, which Jack was threatening to shatter into a thousand pieces, the Joint Chiefs, who were upset when he did not invade Cuba, contrary to their unanimous recommendation, signed an above-ground test ban treaty with the Soviet Union, contrary to their unanimous opposition, and now is pulling our forces out of Vietnam, where they thought a stand had to be taken against the expansion of international godless communists. The anti-Castro Cubans, of course, who thought he had betrayed them at the Bay of Pigs. The bankers related to the Fed, because JFK was had already instructed the Department of the Treasury to print hundreds of millions of United States notes on the ground that it was absurd for the government to be paying interest to a consortium of private banks for printing its own currency. The oil men, of course, as you mentioned, were worried that Jack was going to cut the oil depletion allowance. And Israel, last but not least, where he and David Ben-Gurion were at loggerheads over Israel's desire to develop nuclear weapons, which Jack opposed, but Israel desired. So they all were supporters as sponsors. But the key players were Lyndon Johnson in setting it up and J. Edgar in covering it up.
No question. The only one I think you missed in that litany is the false narrative we've been given about the Cuban Missile Crisis. We were told after the fact that Jack and Bobby bravely faced Nikita Khrushchev down and he removed his missiles. In fact, they made a secret backroom deal, which was kept from the American people for 40 years. We removed our missiles from Turkey and Italy, changing the balance of power in the European theater. The Pentagon, the Joint Chiefs, knew this in real time. That information was classified for 40 years. Add that to the Bay of Pigs, and you can see why the military-industrial complex wanted Jack Kennedy gone.
And, of course, they succeeded, and we had a succession of presidents who would never have occupied that office but for his death. In fact, one of the fears of the right wing at the time was that Jack would serve two terms to be succeeded by Bobby for two terms and then by Teddy for two more terms. They had to cut off the dynasty before it would begin, which they proceeded to do. So we have Lyndon Johnson, his successor. He held back supporting Hubert Humphrey, who could have effortlessly won in favor of Richard Nixon, who'd also been complicit in the crime. And, of course, when he resigned, Gerald Ford, who'd been J. Edgar's man on the Warren Commission, came into office. Jimmy Carter was an anomaly. When Ronald Reagan acceded to the presidency with George Herbert Walker Bush as his vice president, Reagan got the message after the attempt on his life, and the government was virtually run from that point on by George Herbert Walker Bush. Then, of course, we had Bill Clinton, and I want to go into this now with you in considerable detail, Roger, only to be succeeded by W., who brought us the disaster of 9/11. And it's utterly fascinating how Jeb Bush committed an enormous blunder, Roger, by saying in response to a criticism of Donald Trump that his brother had kept us safe, which has reopened the issue of 9/11. Frankly, I mean, you have Hillary being pilloried for the death of foreign Benghazi, but W. and Cheney were in office when 3,000 Americans were taken out. It's a huge issue in which they were profoundly involved because 9/11 was actually brought to us by the CIA, the neocons in the Department of State, and the Mossad. But now we have Hillary being grilled today, and I got to tell you, Roger, your book is utterly fascinating. You make so many damning points, but I think this Benghazi hearing is going to convince the American people that Hillary is the right person to be president of the United States. She's handling it so deftly. There's never been a witness before a Senate hearing that is so well prepared. And the Republicans overplayed themselves by admitting the whole thing was political, intended to drive down her poll numbers. It's all being reversed now. She's getting a tremendous sympathy vote. I think she's becoming an irresistible force, Roger.
Well, you know what? It's not over till it's over. And I'm not ready to concede that. Now, I'm at a disadvantage because I haven't been able to watch the hearings because I have been doing a series of radio shows talking about this book. I will look at it this evening. There's so much dirt there. And I don't need to tell you, Bush, Clinton, Bush, Clinton, the policies are exactly the same. It's very interesting to see the way the mainstream media is apoplectic about the fact that Donald Trump has criticized the accepted narrative that the Bushes kept us safe. It's causing a reexamination about what we knew and when we knew it. And this is even buried inside the 9/11 Commission report. We had numerous hints that something was afoot. We had numerous tips that men were being trained to fly planes into buildings, but they weren't being trained on how to land those planes. So one has to assume, and you know Trump, he's not going to back down. He's going to continue to pursue this line of questioning. Hillary Clinton is a fraud. She is not the person you see in these hearings. She's not the person you saw in that snooze fest debate last week. She is a violent, short-tempered, foul-mouthed little megalomaniac. And I think that will yet come out to the American people. You know, a lot of my friends don't like Citizens United. I like Citizens United. Why? Because I have people who will give me millions of dollars to take Bill's victims and put them on television. CNN doesn't want to cover that? That's okay. I'll buy CNN wall-to-wall in New Hampshire. Let the women make the case. Let the women who have been assaulted by Bill and then psychologically assaulted by Hillary, let them speak. And I think that that is the most compelling way to make the case. This isn't pretty. Bill Clinton is a serial rapist. He assaults women. He bites them. That's his signature. He bite the upper lip. He did that in the at least three cases that I identified, the case of Liz Ward Grayson, the case of Juanita Broderick, and then a third woman, who is identified by Roger Morris, then of the Washington Post. Morris is not a conservative. The Washington Post is not some right-wing rag. These are establishment organs. So we're dealing with a deep psychopath here. And as I establish in my book with Robert Morrow, Hillary is the one who goes out and hires the heavy-handed private detectives who wage a veritable terror campaign on these women to silence them. The good news is I interviewed 27 women in this book, and a number of them are courageous enough to step forward and speak out. We've begun filming them at a secret location, and you're going to see them on TV. This is politics. I'm a veteran of 9 national presidential campaigns. I recently left the Trump campaign on very good terms. I spoke with Donald this morning. I spoke to him last week. I have given him research that documents in further detail the fact that this country was not kept safe by the Bushes. Frankly, my book in January on the Bushes charts the entire arc of the Bush family from the time that they armed the Nazis under Prescott Bush, made money on slave labor in Auschwitz through their steel mill, which they owned an interest in. George H.W. Bush, overseeing the task force that imports millions of dollars of cocaine into the United States to be sold in order to illegally arm the Nicaraguan Contras and then avoids prosecution by stonewalling a special prosecutor, refusing to be questioned, refusing to turn over any documents. I also go much, much deeper into the Kennedy assassination. You know this, Jim. There are 2 shooters. Andrea Mitchell from NBC blurts that out on television. Then I went back and tried to interview. She doesn't remember any of that. It's interesting when you show the pictures of the actual crime scene, they always crop the photo to crop out the man standing on the balcony on the upper right, who's the other shooter. So I make a much more comprehensive case tying the Bush family to the assassination attempt on Reagan. It's not coincidental.
Yes, yes, yes. And something I love about you, Roger, is you're a truth teller. I think Donald Trump is like the bull in the china shop. He's shaking everything up because he's exposing so much about how the game is really played. The wealthy buying and selling politicians, as his case of getting Hillary to his wedding, she couldn't refuse because he'd given her money. And he is therefore in the process enlightening the American people about the realities, which are very grim, of what's been going on in Washington, D.C. for all of this lengthy period of time.
Absolutely. Look, the guy is fearless and he can't be bought. That's the great thing. In other words, he's so wealthy, he doesn't need the lobbyists. He doesn't need the special interests. He doesn't need the Koch brothers. He doesn't need a super PAC. He doesn't need some billionaire to bankroll his career. All these other career politicians, they have been on the tit of the special interests their whole life. They have been pandering for campaign contributions their entire life. Trump will not be bought and he will not be bullied. Frankly, I'm glad to hear that the Secret Service has finally agreed to protect him, although I have urged him to increase his personal security.
Yes.
Loyal to him, paid for by him. I know the head of his security detail. I know his security people. They are really first rate and they know what they're doing, but he's a danger to the system.
Yes.
He is identifying for the American people that the system is broken. It's rigged against the average people. This morning somebody asked me, they said, oh, well, it says here in your biography that you call yourself an alternative historian. What does that mean? I said, it's very simple. It means I don't believe what the government tells us about anything. What? Not about Watergate, not about the Vietnam War, not about the Kennedy assassination, not about the King assassination, not about the Robert Kennedy assassination, not about Obamacare, not about 9/11. I don't believe anything the government tells us. They never tell us the truth. And it's up to people like you and I, Jim, to go out there and dig.
What means, Roger, is you believe in evidence-based history, not simple propaganda or stories the government tells that they want us to believe simply on their say-so, especially when there's abundant and compelling evidence that contradicts it.
Yeah, exactly. So you can call us conspiracy theorists if you want. We both know that that's a put-down that was invented by the agency to try to discredit anyone who disagrees with the government's version of events. The good news is I think the internet has changed everything. It's much, much harder to control information now. Back in the days when you only had NBC, CBS, and ABC, when you only had a handful of national newspapers, if it didn't happen on the three networks, it didn't happen. When I was in Dallas for the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, and through my own personal relationships, I had an interview on the Fox affiliate in Dallas. It was the first time in history anyone on Dallas television has ever been able to lay the blame at the foot of Lyndon Johnson and his plotters at the agency, the mob, Big Texas Oil, and the other participants in the plot. It was historic. And the phone calls they got, the congratulatory phone calls they got at Fox, we jammed their switchboard for an hour of people saying, I always believed Johnson did it. I always knew Johnson did it. I always knew Johnson was involved. The people they're hungry for the truth. They will embrace the truth if somebody will lay it out for them. I'm hopeful that I can get back on when I'm in Dallas this November 27th.
Well, I think what's so sensational about you, Roger, is because of your background, you cannot be discredited as some kind of kook. I mean, you have too much established political credentials working with a series of presidents, and behind the scenes, you know how things happen. And therefore, an outfit like Fox would have a very tough time trying to discredit you, although they make those efforts again and again, including with me and others related to 9/11. But they've never shown the courage or integrity to have me on about JFK.
Yeah, it's a matter of trying to break through. I was scheduled to be on MSNBC yesterday. It's very interesting that when I resigned from the Trump campaign a month ago now, and I assure you, I left Donald Trump on very good terms. He's been a friend of mine for 35 years. I was at two of his three weddings. He was at my wedding. I attended the wake and funeral for both of his parents. I helped make his sister a federal judge under Reagan. She's a very respected and independent jurist. You know, I have great affection for Donald Trump, and I know firsthand how fearless he is. But the media wanted to play this up. And I guess they thought that if I went on television, I would trash Trump. So they were very quick to book me, CNN, MSNBC, NPR, all the usual suspects, the most controlled media assets like the Washington Post. Suddenly, these people who would not normally give me the time of day, they're clamoring for an interview because they confidently believe that I'm going to go on television and attack Trump. So, of course, I said yes to every request. And then I went on and told them why I still support Trump and why I think it is essential that we allow him to take on the power structure in this company. Now, when I contact those same producers, the ones who were kissing my derriere to come on the air, I mean, I actually literally had George Stephanopoulos on one line and Matt Lauer on the other begging me to do the Good Morning America show over the Today show. Those same people, Jim, not surprising to you. You know what I hear from them today? Crickets. Nothing.
Roger, they don't like truth somehow. They don't like truth. It's like when Bernie Sanders in the Democratic debate was prevailing in the polls and among the viewers by 70 to 20, Roger. The talking heads on the media was saying how Hillary had prevailed. But she'd been wiped out by Sanders. They can't bring themselves to speak the truth if it doesn't favor the candidate they want to succeed to represent the establishment, which Hillary does better than anyone else by far.
Yeah, I mean, look, she's too old for this. I do think she's got some underlying health issues. I think there's many, many vulnerabilities. I go into this in the book. Look, I'm disturbed by her relationship with Huma Abedin, who I like to refer to as Mrs. Carlos Danger. First of all, Huma is the only person in the history of the U.S. government and the history of the State Department to be given a special waiver so that she can have a full-time job at the State Department. At the same time, she's being paid by a lobbying company that represents a number of Middle Eastern countries and is lobbying the State Department. At the same time, she's allowed to triple dip at the Clinton Foundation. Now, the Clinton Foundation is a slush fund for grifters. It is not a charity. Their charitable works, their real charitable works, are negligible. Really what it is a fund in which people could pay bribes to the Clintons through their foundation or to them directly in many cases where they would disguise these bribes as speaking fees, as honorariums for speeches. So if you had a big defense contract on Hillary's desk for approval, because they require the approval of the Secretary of State, or if you wanted a policy changed, or if you want approval to take control of the uranium production in the United States, you would have to bribe the Clintons. And their foundation was the vehicle they used for these bribes. In any event, Huma's relationship with the Muslim Brotherhood, through both her parents and her grandparents and her brothers, is very clearly there. Yet she has full access to what are theoretically U.S. classified documents. And then there's the fact that when she travels with Hillary Clinton, they stay in the same room. Now, we're told that that's because of a health condition that Hillary has. Well, if she has a health condition that's that acute, we ought to know about that because she's running for president. I'm deeply concerned by the relationship between Hillary Clinton and Huma Abedin, and I have no idea how this woman got a security clearance given her personal relationships.
Is Huma the wife of the Congressman Wiener from New York City?
Yes, that's who calls himself Carlos Danger when he is tweeting out pictures of his man parts to underage girls.
Roger, where do we get these sick people in government? That seems to be a yardstick. The sicker you are, the further you go.
Well, and is it incidental that both Hillary and Huma have been humiliated by their husbands in public, but they stay with them? Why? Because of power lust. It's all about the power and the wealth and the agenda of the two-party duopoly. Yeah. The country is run by a two-party duopoly. In 1992, when George H.W. Bush was defeated, they were as apoplectic about Ross Perot then as they are about Donald Trump now. Perot was a billionaire. He couldn't be controlled. He knew that we had left POWs behind in Vietnam. But more importantly, he knew the government was trafficking in narcotics. He was very angry about it. It's why he ran. When George Bush looked at his watch in that debate, what he was telling us was it was over for him. His designated role was to lose to his former CIA alum, Bill Clinton. People say, oh, he's the greatest president of the age. Really? Which election did he get 51% in? I mean, Richard Nixon, who's a mentor of mine, but a distasteful guy, a guy with some personality problems. He got 51% of the vote. In fact, he did much better than that. Bill Clinton became president in two three-way races in which if Ross Perot had never run, he would never have been president. So just like the fix was in then, the fix is in now. Jeb Bush's role is designated loser. His job is to lose. And when he's finished losing, should he become the nominee of the Republican Party, he will go back to making millions of dollars with the Clintons. As I say in my book, they raise $138 million for Haitian earthquake relief. They spend $10 million in Haiti building housing, and they pocket the other $128 million. Now they close the nonprofit. The Clintons take half the money. The Bushes take the other half, and nobody asks any questions. That's just one example of the Bushes and the Clintons covering for each other, rehabilitating each other. What is it Barbara Bush says? She says Bill Clinton is like the fourth Bush brother. And what is it that George W. Bush says? He says Hillary Clinton is like my sister-in-law. Well, they're all in it together. Their policies are identical, and they profiteer together. That's why my book on the Clintons has a lot to do with their relationship with the Bushes, and my upcoming book on the Bushes has a great deal to do with the Clintons. I mean, frankly, at the rate I'm going, I'm the one who's going to need Secret Service.
I believe that, Roger. I believe that. Listen, how did Bill ever become, a candidate for president in the first place? I mean, was this something that was prearranged?
Yeah, I think it was. Here's what we know, and that is he has no degree from Oxford. I should say he has never earned a good degree from Oxford. He got an honorary degree from Oxford much later when he was president. He was thrown out of Oxford because he raped a 19-year-old co-ed named Eileen Wellstone. This is confirmed in the State Department records. It's also confirmed in the Oxford records. He was bounced out of there. Now, in his biographies, he says that he left Oxford because he was accepted at Yale Law School. The problem is that there's a one-year delay between the time that they bounce him out of Oxford and the time he starts studying at Yale.
Sure.
In that year, he's working for the Central Intelligence Agency. Cord Myers says in his biography that he was recruited at Oxford and they used him to infiltrate anti-Vietnam War groups in Europe. He had no visible financial means of support. The agency paid for him to bum around Europe for a year and show up and spy on his fellow anti-war protesters. So yeah, I think he is an agency man from the beginning, as is George Bush. As you point out, Bush was involved with the Central Intelligence Agency as early as 1961. He is a low-level functionary in the Bay of Pigs. His job is raising money from right-wing zealots to support the invasion. He, therefore, when he becomes CIA director much later under Gerald Ford, and he testifies under oath that he has never been affiliated previously with the agency, he's perjuring himself.
Absolutely.
And as you know, he claims for 30 years that he can't remember where he was on November 22nd, 1960.
Perjury is the least of the crimes these people commit, Roger.
To say the least. But what we now know is he's staying at the Sheraton Hotel, only blocks from Dealey Plaza. And he goes out of his way to establish an alibi. I happen to believe that all of those involved in the plot, including J. Edgar, had a failsafe. So if things went wrong, Hoover was prepared to be a whistleblower. If the plot fell apart, he would have arrested everybody involved and taken credit for it. Hoover's not one of the plotters. He knows all about it. He's more involved in the cover-up. He lets it go down.
Well,
he swoops right in to cover it up.
He's actually at the home of Clint Murchison Sr. the night before, Roger.
Yes.
Where it was the ratification meeting. Richard Nixon was there. Madeline Duncan Brown, with whom I had over 100 conversations, remembered how Nixon was driven out there by a local Republican leader who worked in the same bank where she was a young advertising executive. George Brown, Brown and Root Heavy Construction, which had received a contract, no bid, to dredge a new port at Cam Ranh Bay, even though Vietnam has many magnificent natural ports and no doubt did not need this one, received $1 billion for that. John J. McCloy, former High Commissioner to Germany, Chief Executive Officer at Chase Manhattan Bank, was there as well. And of course, when Lyndon showed up late in the evening, unexpected to most, they disappeared into a board meeting for 15 or 20 minutes. And when it broke up, he strode over to Madeline. She expected he was going to whisper sweet nothings in her ear. Instead, he told her in a hateful tone of voice that he was not going to have to put up with embarrassment from those Kennedy boys after tomorrow. That was not a threat. That was a promise. 6 weeks later, they had a rendezvous in the Driscoll Hotel in Austin, Texas on New Year's Eve, where Madeline confronted him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved since no one stood to gain more personally. He blew up at her and told her the oil boys in the CIA had decided that Jack had to be taken out.
Yeah, I have, as you probably know, I have some very slight disagreements with that narrative. I have a hard time reconciling Nixon being seen at his hotel by a Dallas Times news reporter. I think that he's at the Murchison Ranch earlier in the evening. I really kind of believe James Tague's take on this. I think Nixon is a problem for these guys. He's the one guy who's going to put together all the pieces. I believe he and Johnson met the day before at the Adelphus Hotel. According to Charles McWhorter, Johnson asked Nixon to call Congressman Bruce Alger, a right-wing Republican, big critic of JFK, and tell him to tamp it down, that he was calling the president a traitor. This is a false flag. This is to send Nixon on a false, mission, a wild goose chase. Nixon, I believe, cannot be in two places at once. Although, interestingly, as you know, there's some who say, well, Johnson couldn't have been at the Murchison Ranch because he was seen, not heard, in Fort Worth that night, late in the evening. My friend Phil Nelson, whose two books on Lyndon Johnson are indispensable, has established that Johnson often used a body double, a man who was actually a first cousin of his who looked exactly like him. And this man was used on a number of occasions when Johnson wanted to appear to be in two places at once. This poor bastard, several years later, signs up to do a TV show playing Lyndon Johnson. It appears in Variety, the industry newspaper. Johnson finds out about it, blows up, and guess what? Somebody murders Johnson's cousin.
What?
And the murderer is never found.
It's just as he had Malcolm Mack Wallace murder one of his own sisters because she was talking too much about Lyndon's business.
Yes.
I mean, he murdered a dozen people for Lyndon, participated in the assassination of JFK, took out Henry Marshall, an agriculture inspector, was shot five times with a single-shot bolt-action rifle. When he came out to discover whether or not there were the enormous cotton allotments Billy Saul had put up as collateral for these enormous loans from the Department of Agriculture, there was carbon monoxide in his lungs. He'd been rendered unconscious by a blow to the head, Roger, and the local justice of the peace declared it to be a suicide.
A Johnson man, I might add.
Of course. Absolutely. Yeah,
no, there's no question, although, as you know, the mendacious Joan Mellon insists that Billy Saul is the one who actually killed Henry Marshall.
I have nothing kind to say about Joan Mellon.
That would make two of us. She continues to tell people that my book on Lyndon Johnson, a New York Times bestseller, which has sold 89,000 copies. Match that, Joan. She keeps telling people my book has no footnotes and no source notes. That's why I instructed my attorneys to file a $25 million lawsuit against her in her home state of New Jersey. We tried to serve her in New Orleans this weekend. She escaped service by running away, but I know where she lives and she will be served.
You'll catch her, Roger. Good luck with that. I'm all on your side.
You know, I'm happy to take her house if she doesn't have the money. I believe in truth. By the way, all I want is an apology. I don't want the money. Just acknowledge that my book does have footnotes and source notes.
Well, of course.
And she says, well, you rely on secondary sources. Yeah, you know what? Jim Tague was there. Jim Tague was a good man. Jim Tague told the truth. Yes, I rely on what he told me.
Anyone who does serious
research
has to relate their work to the previously existing literature, Roger. It's a standard of scholarship. It's indicative that Joan Mellon is unqualified to address these issues that she should make such a claim.
Yeah, no, look, I've said from the very beginning, I stand on the shoulders of giants. But for Barr McClellan, but for Phil Nelson, but for guys like you, Jim, and many others who had the courage to research and write what they found dispassionately, who went at it without any preconceived notion. I'm sure when you began, you didn't know everything you know today. So, yes, I absolutely have relied on the works of other people who I trust and respect. We're all building. We all learn new things. Here's what I know. I worked for Richard Nixon. I spent an enormous amount of time with him. And he was not a very socially loquacious guy. He was very introspective. He was not very introspective, and he was really not very retrospective, meaning you couldn't get him to talk about the McCarthy days or Eisenhower or Alger Hiss or all these fantastic things that had happened in his career. When you were with Nixon, he wanted to talk about what was going to happen next week. He was always forward looking. How's Clinton doing? How's Bush doing? How come Bush is so stupid? He would say. What happened to Bush? He said, I knew Prescott. Tough as nails. Smart guy. What happened to George? He's a dummy. These are his words, not mine. So when I asked Nixon about Johnson, it was only after he'd had a few cocktails. Nixon was not a drunk. LBJ was a drunk. He was an alcoholic.
Yes.
But Nixon could not tolerate alcohol. So two drinks would inebriate him. Three drinks, and he would start singing and slapping you on the back. So I would wait until Nixon had a few cocktails. And by the way, I drank with him. He made an incredible martini, which he called a silver bullet. You would come into his home in Saddle River, and he would say, how about a silver bullet? You know, I only allow myself one. And, of course, then he would have two. And I said to him finally, so what about Johnson? He said, well, that was the difference between Lyndon and I. We both wanted to be president. I just wasn't willing to kill for it. And that, of course, is in my book. I also interviewed Nick Rui. Now, Rick Rui was Nixon's body man. In the 1980 campaign, Nick Rui, who was 20 years older than I am, now deceased, was assigned to work for me. So I have a guy who knows far more than I will ever know assigned to work for me because Nixon had called Ronald Reagan and Nancy Reagan, who he knew very well from California in the 60s, and he said he wanted to make his man available to the campaign. And they didn't have a place for Rui. So they assigned him to me, and he worked in my office helping me on a number of things. But he liked a cocktail also. He came from a very wealthy family in Grosse Pointe, Michigan. He was a great hunter, fisherman, just a great guy to be with, an all-around sportsman. He liked to drink. He liked a cigarette. And he liked to talk. And I asked him, you were with Nixon on November 22nd and 23rd and 24th. And he said that, yes, that he had been there. He'd just come in. Nixon was scheduled to have lunch with Mary Roebling, whose family built the Brooklyn Bridge, very wealthy New Jersey, New York Republicans, longtime benefactors for the Nixon political career. And they were late for lunch. And he came in, and Nixon had just seen Jack Ruby blow away Lee Harvey Oswald on national television. And he said Nixon was white as a ghost. And he mumbled, I know that guy. And Rui said, pardon me, sir. Nixon said, never mind. Now, to me, this proves what Rui told me was that Murray Shatner, who was Nixon's eminent grease, the guy who invented negative campaigning, the real quarterback of Nixon's early political career, the guy who maneuvered him on the ticket with Eisenhower, a little help from Prescott Bush there, that Johnson in the House had realized that Nixon had excess money in a committee budget. I worked in the U.S. House. I also worked in the U.S. Senate. I worked for Bob Dole. I worked for Congressman Bob Steele. And I can tell you, when there's excess money, the members are allowed to use it to hire additional staff or consultants. According to Rui, Lyndon Johnson is the one who brought Jack Rubenstein to Murray because he knew that was the way to get it done. And Murray brought Ruby to Nixon and said, Lyndon says you've got excess money on the UAC committee and he would like this guy picked up as a consultant. I'm going to guess that this was, and this is just supposition, a favor for Marcello. That's my guess. I can't prove that, but I think it is a probability. So it proves a Ruby-Nixon connection, but more importantly, and I have every reason to believe Nick Rui, now gone to his maker, it proves a Johnson-Ruby connection.
Yeah, that's fascinating. He was an investigator for the House Select Committee on Un-American Activities, of which Nixon was a member in around 1948, I'm guessing, Roger, that would be the period of time.
47, so, according to the records of the payroll records. Now, what I think he really was, by the way, was an informant. I think he was a paid informant. As you know, well, the Warren Commission said he had no known associations with organized crime, which is laughable. He was a button man for Marcello. He'd worked for Marcello.
Oh, sure.
He had been a knee breaker in Chicago, and he had, and the club that he owned, the Carousel Club, he was just fronting for Marcelo. Well, he didn't own the club. Marcelo owned the club.
Yeah, he was the local arrangements chairman for the mob in relation to the assassination. There's no doubt, Roger. And you know, the number of phone calls he was getting from mobsters just skyrocketed the week before the assassination.
Well, interestingly enough, there is, I'm sure you've seen it, there is a record in which it's essentially a memo authorizing the committee, the clerk of the House, to put Jack Rubenstein on the House Un-American Activities Committee payroll authorized by Congressman Richard Nixon. And people have tried to discredit this because when it was copied, there's a buck slip on top of it with a zip code, which, of course, predates, you know, the origination of the memo. In other words, it would be after. There were no zip codes in 1947. So some have tried to discredit that document. I went to the clerk of the House to try to find this document, and they don't have it. And I said, well, does that mean that this is not real? They said, no, that's not what we said. A number of documents disappeared here through a fire in the late 50s. It is possible that this document was lost. It is also possible that it is in a warehouse. So no one would tell me that it was a fraud. At the same time, they would not produce it. It was found in the files of the House Select Committee of Assassinations. That's where the original document comes from. I have reason to believe that document is accurate, that Jack Ruby was put on the congressional payroll by Congressman Richard Nixon, but I believe it was at the behest of his colleague, Congressman Lyndon Johnson. By the way, that is a very standard thing in the House. Members will ask other members to pick up another person on their payroll, regardless of party. Because, as you know, even in the 50s, there's only one party, really.
Sure. Yes, yes, yes. Well, I'm convinced they had to draw Nixon in because he'd come so close to winning the election with JFK. It was highly probable he'd become president in the future, and they couldn't afford to have someone who was willing to reopen the investigation into the death of JFK. So I believe they had to draw him in very early on, Roger.
I think they drew him in for a slightly different reason. I think they thought, like most people, he was washed up. Their problem was he knew everybody involved, and he was going to put the pieces together. He knew Hoover. He knew Ruby. He knew the ruthlessness of the Kennedys. He knew that Johnson would stop at nothing. He knew the mob guys, although his affiliations with the mob were more West Coast oriented. He was the guy who would know immediately, given how suspicious he was, what happened. And therefore, he had to be handled. He had to be drawn in. It's Don Kendall, the head of PepsiCo, who has deep relationships with the Central Intelligence Agency surrounding the sugar trade out of Cuba, who maneuvers Nixon into even being in town. He's in town, as you know, to address a PepsiCo bottlers convention. And he's billing by the hour. So it's a very lucrative gig for Nixon because he represents PepsiCo as an attorney. He's very definitely maneuvered into the scene and handled. I'm not sure he's at the late night meeting because he has no power in 1963. He is as washed up as you can get, because you'll recall he loses the presidency. And after that, he loses the White House. I make the case in my book, Nixon's Secrets. It's stolen from him, not in Chicago, in Texas. The real egregious stealing happens in Texas. By the way, if you deduct the 26 electoral votes from Illinois, that doesn't put Nixon over the top. You need one other state, and that other state is Lyndon Johnson's Texas. The Johnson-Kennedy ticket only carries Texas by 46,000 votes. 136,000 paper ballots in Dallas County that were marked, that where people had circled Nixon and Lodge, were burned on election night. Lyndon Johnson doing the, LBJ's doing the counting, which is, you know, he was very adept at.
Well, of course, he got into the Senate on the Box 13 scandal, so this is perfectly traditional for Lyndon. Let me ask this. Was Watergate really an effort to find out if Larry O'Brien and the Democrats had any evidence tying Nixon to the assassination?
I think that there's several things going on at once. Watergate is not simple. There is no one simple explanation, meaning of the perpetrators of the break-in, they're not even being honest with each other about what they're looking for. There's a CIA contingent, and then there's a non-CIA contingent. Gordon Liddy is unfortunately a patsy. I know Gordon very well. Howard Hunt's been lying to him from the beginning, as has James McCord. So half of the Watergate burglars are there to uncover the Democratic National Committee's connection to a call girl ring which is located down the street, which is being used by a number of high-level Democrats. When they come to town, the DNC can arrange female company for you. Unbeknownst to them, the Republican National Committee, the White House, the State Department, they're all using the same cat house. By the way, my friend Nick Rui, who I referred to, Nixon's traveling aide, he was a regular at this whorehouse. So it's a bipartisan operation. But there is a book which has pictures of the women who are available that's in a locked desk drawer. Eugenio Martinez, still alive, 92 years old. I interviewed him in a restaurant in Havana, and he told me that when he was arrested, he had the key to the drawer, and he had been assigned to recover this book. He tried to swallow the key, and they slammed him against a wall, and they took it from him. Meanwhile, I think others involved here are trying to find out whether O'Brien has some documents that tie Nixon to the plots to kill Fidel Castro, which very definitely Nixon green-lighted when he was the head of a task force under Eisenhower to kill Castro. This was why Nixon thought the debates wouldn't matter. He was counting on the murder of Castro, the assassination of Castro in the weeks before the election. He thought this would put him over the top because it would have been an accomplishment of the Eisenhower administration. It would have been kind of like the phony killing of bin Laden. I don't believe bin Laden was murdered either. Why would we bury his body at sea and take no pictures?
Sure. No, he actually died in Afghanistan on or about 15 December 2001 from his medical maladies. He was buried there in an unmarked grave. There were local obituaries. David Ray Griffin has a book about it, entitled Osama Bin Laden Dead or Alive. Nick Kohlerstrom, an historian of science from the UK, has an article about it, Osama Bin Laden, 1957 to 2001. Even Fox News was on top of this story, Roger. They published a report, Osama Bin Laden already dead, on 26 December 2001. You can still find it online. Yes. And when they came out with a ridiculous film about Zero Dark 30, I exposed the whole hoax in an article entitled Zero Dark 30, The Deeper, Darker Truths, about the second death of Osama bin Laden arranged for political purposes to get Barack Obama off of the hot seat about his fake Hawaiian death certificate, complaints that he hadn't closed Guantanamo, and the stationing of troops in Pakistan. They claimed that the tip about the location of Osama had come from Guantanamo. Oh, aren't we glad it's still open? Using troops in Pakistan. Gee, I'm blessed we're glad they're still there. And wiped his birth certificate off the front page and positioned himself for a triumphal reelection, forgetting the most wanted man in the world who'd only been dead for a decade.
This is the first time Donald Trump becomes a real pain in the ass to the establishment, because he won't drop the issue of Obama's birth. And it drives them crazy. That's why they have to produce this phony birth certificate, because Trump won't drop this. See, Trump, prior to his raising this, as you know, there was no one in the mainstream who would talk about this. Anybody who brought it up was termed a kook, a lunatic, some kind of nut job. So Trump, who is, let's face it, because of The Apprentice and because of his long career, he's universally known. He starts asking questions about Obama's birth. How incredibly inconvenient this is. Really, this is really the first rise of Trump. By the way, it's not surprising. 3 years ago, when Trump first raised the questions about Obama, if you think about it, he zoomed to the head of the polls. He wasn't even a candidate, but he was leading he was leading Mitt Romney, he was leading John McCain, he was leading Mike Huckabee and all these established politicians, because he raised this very politically incorrect question. Now, I think you're exactly on the money. So, to go back to Nixon, he was counting on the assassination of Castro to put him over the top in 1960. And of course, that didn't happen for a series of reasons, and it was one of the contributing factors in his loss.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. So Nixon was behind Watergate, but the reasons were multiple, including this book of women available at a brothel that was being used but not by Nixon, right? Nixon wasn't into sex.
No, I think this is all being driven by John Dean. John Dean is the man who plans, executes, and then covers up the Watergate break-in. Two decorated New York policemen, Tony Ulasewicz and
Uku Ziglu.
I'll think of his name. In any event, two of them both write in their own biographies and in oral histories that exist at Texas A&M, that they're investigators working for White House counsel John Dean, and Dean sends them to the Watergate to case out the place 6 weeks before the break-in. Dean, in his most recent book, which he says is the definitive account of Watergate, in which he takes all of the Watergate tapes and transcribes them, he purposely omits his conversations with Nixon on March 16th, 17th, 18th, and 21st. The reason for that is you can find out that it's by listening to those that it's not Nixon coaching Dean, it's Dean coaching Nixon. Dean lies to Nixon for 19 months about the origins of the Watergate break-in. This is John Dean's idea. Dean is the one who pushes Jeb Magruder, who pushes Liddy to go in with a team. Dean wants the book of hookers because his wife's picture is in it.
Is Maureen actually running the call girl ring, or is she simply a participant?
She's simply a participant. It is interesting, when my good friend Len Kolodny wrote this in his book, Silent Coup, he was sued by Dean, an 18-year epic lawsuit which settled out of court. He goes around claiming that he won that suit. He did not win that suit. But it is interesting that Dean and his lawyers fought in the suit to seal all the information about his wife, Maureen Dean's background. That's because she was a high-priced prostitute, and she had been passed around to a number of very high-powerful men. She was one of these $1,000-an-hour girls. I say that openly. I wish Mr. Dean would sue me. He threatens to sue everyone else. There's a new book out by Ray Locker, terrific book, called Nixon's Gamble. I saw the letter that Dean and his lawyers sent to Ray, who's a courageous investigative journalist, threatening to sue him. I confronted Dean at the Texas Book Festival last year. You can go on YouTube and see the video. He melted. He won't answer my questions. This guy is a weasel.
He is the
progenitor of the Watergate break-in.
Haven't he and Maureen now gone their separate ways?
No, I believe they're still together.
And is there any connection to the Mayflower Madam, you know, the more recent case where Dick Cheney seems to have been involved?
No, I think that's a different sex scandal. But now it is also true, as Lamar Waldron has written, that there's another contingent that wants to get into the Watergate to find out what O'Brien has over Nixon. There's two possibilities. O'Brien had gone to work for Howard Hughes as a secret lobbyist, secret because he never registered to lobby for Hughes, so he's a rainmaker. And as you know, Hughes had lent Nixon's brother a substantial amount of money in the closing days of the Eisenhower administration. And this has come back to bite Nixon in the derriere twice, in the close of the 1960 election when Bobby Kennedy tried to sell it to Drew Pearson, but they were late, and many, many, many of the newspapers who carried Pearson's column saw it as a late hit and refused to carry that column. But then it is revived in the 1962 election when Nixon runs for governor. So let's go back to the Murchison rants. Nixon controls nothing in 1963. He's out of government. He's viewed as a washed-up loser with no future prospects. He himself self-immolates his career with his famous last press conference when, in a fit of pique, he says, you know, think what you're going to be missing. You won't have Dick Nixon to kick around anymore, because, gentlemen, this is my last press conference. 6 years later, he is raising his hand to be sworn in as president of the United States. That could not have happened without the death of John Kennedy, the death of Dr. King, the death of Robert Kennedy, and the bungling of the Vietnam War by Lyndon Johnson. All of those events were necessary for Nixon's incredible comeback, and none of them could have been foreseen in November of 1963, when he was generally viewed as a pain in the ass, a washed-up hack with no future political prospects and no friends in Washington.
Roger, this is utterly fascinating. We're going to take a break and then return to pursue these issues, especially in relation to your new book. I can't tell you how pleased I am to have you here. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. My very special guest today, Roger Stone, will be right back.
We can now say with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service,
the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Less than 3% of you people read books. Because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen to it.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my interview with Roger Stone, the author of The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ, and now his latest book, The Clintons' War on Women. It's a fascinating read. Some of these women, by the way, that Bill has violated or abused, such as Kathleen Wiley or Juanita Broderick, these are very fetching women. I mean, they're extremely attractive, Roger.
Yeah, unfortunately, not all of his victims were that attractive. Look, the whole idea that Hillary is an advocate for women and children is just false. Let's start from the beginning. She's an advocate for women unless you're one of those women who is unlucky enough to have been sexually assaulted by her husband. And if you are, now you become a target. First, her running dog lackeys like James Carville and that twisted little freak David Brock. They denounce you as a bimbo, a whore, a slut, trash. As Hillary says, who's going to believe these women? They're trash. And then it's Hillary who hires the heavy-handed private detectives like Anthony Palladino Jack Palladino, Anthony Pelicano, Ivan Duda, to track these women and then to terrorize them into silence. And, of course, that the motive there is to stop them from getting in the way of the electoral success of the Clintons. And these are directly attributable to Hillary. Hillary is the one wearing the pants in this relationship. Hillary is the one who is both power and money hungry. And now, because of the mainstream media, we have this idea that Bill is just an affable old rogue with an eye for the ladies. No, he is a sexual a predator. He assaults these women. His trademark move, Jim, is to bite their upper lip.
And Roger, this appears to have been true from an early age. You know, you mentioned Eileen Wellstone at Oxford. Was Bill a Rhodes Scholar at that point?
No, he is. That's why we call him the Rhodes Scholar rapist, because they threw him out of Oxford.
Yeah, but I mean, that's outrageous. You know, if he was there on a Rhodes Scholarship, to commit a heinous offense like this is just despicable.
But you understand elite deviants. There are some people in the country who have so much power or influence or so politically connected, there are no rules for them. The laws don't apply for them.
And Bill was what, 22 years old or so when he raped Eileen?
He rapes Eileen, then he's picked up by the CIA, according to Cord Meyer, and he begins his work for them. Then he comes back and he runs for Congress. It's interesting, he meets Hillary at Yale, but he cheats on her from the minute he meets her. When he's running for Congress, he's got a woman stashed in every county in his district. He is a sexual, and he's a serial rapist. There's no other way to put it. And I identify in the book with Robert Morrow 27 individual women that he has assaulted. In some cases, he's unsuccessful. So take the case of Paula Jones. He lures her to a hotel room. He exposes himself and he demands oral sex. She escapes. Then he vehemently denies that he's ever met her. He insists it's all a holdup. He's never met her. And then ultimately, he is forced to admit under oath in the Paula Jones investigation. And again, in the Monica Lewinsky investigation, that indeed he has met and tried to have sex with Jones. And he pays her $850,000 in a legal settlement. Why would he pay her unless he was, in fact, guilty? So, you know, people need to know this narrative. But they also need to know that when Hillary talks about pay inequality, it's fraudulent. In no place where Hillary has been the boss, not the U.S. Senate, not the State Department, not the Clinton Foundation, has she ever paid women as much or more than she pays men? Meanwhile, over at the Clinton Foundation, which is a slush fund for grifters, which is just simply set up to augment the jet set lifestyle of the Clintons, they're taking millions of dollars from foreign regimes, Oman, Qatar, Saudi, Algeria, Brunei, where women are oppressed. Women are not allowed to vote. They're not allowed to be educated. They're not allowed to choose their own husbands. They're not allowed to show their faces. They're not allowed to drive a car. And of course, you know, their rape laws are famous. If a woman is raped, she shall be stoned to death. The men pay no penalty. So this is dirty money. It's tainted money, millions of it. Yet the Clintons are taking it and they're using it. The Sultan of Brunei, famous for his underage female harem, he gives $2 million to the presidential library. Bill flies to meet the Sultan in the private plane of Jeffrey Epstein, a convicted pedophile, to pick up the check. These people have no shame. The Clintons cannot be shamed. And I'm convinced that the timing for this book is right. The American people need to know. They need to know that Hillary is a domestic abuser, that Bill is a sexual deviant and a predator, and that Hillary has been an enabler. Among the more stunning things in the book, as you probably know, Jim, is the fact that as much as Hillary chides us, take care of your babies, she says, it takes a village. Bill has a mixed race African-American son in Arkansas that he has refused to acknowledge, to nurture, to support, to love. Danny Williams is the son of Bill Clinton and Bobby Ann Williams, who was a cocaine addicted prostitute. She describes the interior of Bill's mother's home in intimate detail because she trysted there with Bill. Her minister, the Reverend Say McIntosh, raises this question in the final years of Bill's governorship, demanding he take a blood test, demanding that he support Danny Williams. And then McIntosh's son, who's in the Arkansas penitentiary and not eligible for parole legally, gets a full pardon from Governor Bill Clinton. And suddenly the good reverend goes silent. Now, in 1999, when Hillary was warming up to run for the Senate, the Star magazine published a story that said that a DNA test showed that Danny Williams was not the son of Bill Clinton. That was then fed to Howard Kurtz of the Washington Post. The Washington Post reported it, where it was picked up by Time magazine. Jim, there is no DNA test. The owner of the Star, Robert Altman, is a big financial backer of the Clintons. He's given to all of their campaigns the legal maximum. He's also a major donor to the Clinton Foundation. I tracked this down. There is no DNA test. Now, Danny has given us a sample. We're ready for Bill's sample. Let's settle this once and for all. The president should give us a sample. And if he won't, I'll get a sample. Because sooner or later, he's going to drink out of a bottle or a glass or a fork, and his sample will be found. And we can prove once and for all that he has an African-American son and that Bill Clinton is a deadbeat dad. It's even worse than that. He's a deadbeat grandfather because he has five grandchildren that he's never held. By the way, Danny Williams has signed an affidavit. He wants no money. He just wants to shake his father's hand. It's disgraceful the way he has been abused by his father and his stepmother.
Well, you got a picture here, Roger, and he's a spinning image of Bill Clinton. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah, there's no question about this in my mind. The other revelation in the book, of course, is that Chelsea Clinton is not the biological daughter of Bill Clinton. Chelsea Clinton's father is Webster Hubbell. And Webster Hubbell is Hillary's former law partner at the Rose firm and later deputy attorney general. He's the man who transmits the order from Hillary to Janet Reno to go ahead and assault the Waco compound, an assault in which 18 children under the age of 8, innocent children, would die. So Hillary, stop telling us it takes a village to take care of our babies. She is not an advocate for children. She's a murderer of children.
Repeat the point about Waco. How were Webster Hubbell and Hillary involved in Waco?
Webster Hubbell is the deputy attorney general. First of all, Hillary.
Under Janet Reno.
Right. Hillary is the co-president under Bill Clinton. Remember, they didn't hide this. You get two for one, they said in the 92 campaign. Elect Bill Clinton, you get two for one. Hillary vets the entire cabinet. Hillary chooses Janet Reno. Hillary installs her lover and law partner, Webster Hubbell, as the chief deputy attorney general. It is Hillary who tells Webb to tell Janet Reno to order the attack on the Waco combine. How does this come from? T. March Bell, who is the chief investigator for the House committee looking into the Waco assault, says it. And your old friend Arlen Specter, who is the chairman of the committee that looked into Waco in the Senate, ascertained in the closed-door hearings that Hillary had given the order for the assault at Waco. This is all in my book. So to go back to Chelsea, it is interesting to me that Chelsea is born in the closing days of the 1982 election. Bill is struggling for re-election. Hillary gives birth 2 weeks before the election, approximately. Yet there's no announcement from the governor's office. There's no press release. There's no statement. There's no photo of the happy mother and the happy parents with their baby. There's a total news blackout. The fact that Hillary's even had a baby is not publicly reported until after the election. And guess what, Jim? Bill Clinton loses that election. He's ousted from the governor's mansion in that election. So you're going to tell me that the greatest politician of our age, a man who is a political hound dog, is not going to try to benefit from the birth of his daughter on the eve of the only election he ever lost?
You would have thought there would be a surge of enthusiasm and sympathy and support for the Clintons for a newborn.
Exactly.
I can't believe he wouldn't exploit it.
So L.D. Brown, who's Bill Clinton's bodyguard, says in our book that Bill Clinton learned that his wife was pregnant by reading it in the newspaper. Just last week, my co-author Robert Morrow went to a book signing in Austin where Chelsea Clinton was signing her book. He waited patiently in line, and when it was his turn, with a camera running, he said, "Chelsea, did your mother ever tell you that Webster Hubbell is your real father?" And without missing a beat, she looked up and said, "I'm very proud to be the daughter of my parents."
I love it.
That's the non-denial.
I love it.
To say when I work for Nixon. And then on Thursday, my good friend Jerry Corsi contacted and got on the phone with Webster Hubbell at his office in Arkansas and said, are you the father of Chelsea Clinton? And he said, I want to get this quote exactly right, no comment. And he so why won't they just deny this? Why don't they just say this is a smear, this is a lie? I'll tell you why. Because they correctly fear that Roger Stone and Robert Morrow have DNA samples. And they correctly fear that these are going to come out before the 2016 election. Now, people say to me, oh, why are you picking on a little girl? Why are you picking on a child? Jim, she's not a child. She's an adult. And she's a co-conspirator. She and her husband, who is the son of disgraced Ponzi scammer Congressman Ed Medvinsky, who went to prison, have skimmed at least $30 million of their own from the Clinton Foundation. And according to the New York Post, staffers at the Clinton Foundation have said that Chelsea is just like her mother, foul-mouthed, short-tempered, and very abusive. They call her the princess behind her back.
Well, what I was stunned by the photographs with which your photograph section begins is that Chelsea has had plastic surgery to alter her appearance to make her look less like Webster Hubble.
Yeah, if you look at her pictures at 18, 24, and 28, she's had multiple plastic surgery to thin out her lips, to restructure her jaw, to change her nose. And you know what? She still looks like Webb Hubble.
Yeah.
Even with the plastic surgery.
But you can't get away from it.
No, and I took these photos to one of the most respected plastic surgeons in Hollywood, somebody who's worked on many of the stars that you know, and they fed them into a computer. Because as you know, today you can, when somebody goes in wanting substantial facial reconstruction, they want to know what they will look like afterwards. So they can show, they analyze Chelsea's photos, and they can show exactly where the plastic surgery.
The dips and tucks.
Exactly. So I stand by the claim in the book. Why is it important? Because it shows the dysfunctional nature of the Clinton marriage, and it proves what liars they are. Doesn't matter whether Hillary lies about being under sniper fire in Bosnia, or lies about losing the Whitewater billing records, or lies about her email server and whether she had classified documents, or whether she lies about Benghazi and what she knew and when she knew it. This woman is incapable of telling the truth.
Now, Roger, before it slips my mind, you mentioned Monica Lewinsky in passing. My belief has long been that she was a Mossad honey trap. Am I wrong about that?
You know, I don't really know. She may just have been a dumb 19-year-old. And Bill Clinton, as you know, used her private parts as his personal humidor. This is about the power differential because he is much older and has more power than she does. And she was not particularly good-looking at that time. She looks a little better today. I think she has also had a little work, as they say in Hollywood. I actually think it's just a stupid dalliance by Bill, who does these things because he can. Because he can get away with it. That's why he does it.
So he's a sexually obsessed narcissist who's willing to abuse his power and feels no sense of obligation or responsibility for the consequences.
This is why when Gerald Ford met him for the first time, a former president meeting with a current president, Ford urged him to get professional help because he said, you're a sex addict. You need to see a shrink.
But of course, Bill would probably deny it or boast about it. He probably took pride in his sexual addiction.
You know, I'm not sure if he understood how driving it is. The first and only time I met Bill Clinton two times. Once was during a governor's conference when he was the governor of Arkansas. The governor's conference was in New Orleans. I was standing on a street corner with a fellow who was known in political circles as Big Peter Kelly. Big Peter Kelly probably weighed 350 pounds and he was probably 6'7", 6'5". He was a huge man. He's still alive. Friend of mine was chairman of the Connecticut Democratic Party, major fundraiser later for Clinton and then before that for Carter. And I don't want to confuse him with little Peter Kelly, who was the chairman of the Democratic Party in California, who was also a friend of mine, but going on to meet his maker. And Bill Clinton was coming down the street with one girl on either arm, wearing cowboy boots and a big grin. And Kelly yelled out, Governor, what are you doing out here? Right there on Bourbon Street. And Bill just smiled at us and he said, I'm trawling. And I said, that guy's going to be president. Second time I met him was at Richard Nixon's funeral. Because I was a longtime intimate of President Nixon and his family, There was a very small reception after the public funeral for Nixon. Nixon's casket is still in the small room at the Nixon Library. And the Fords are there. The Bushes are there. The Clintons are there. The Nixon family, the Nixon daughters and their husbands are there. And there's a receiving line. This shows how good Bill Clinton is. And as I go through the line, it's my turn, and I shake Clinton's hand, and I say, "Mr. President, I'm Roger Stone." And he takes your hand. He doesn't let go of it. He looks you right in the eye, and he says, "I know how much Nixon meant to you and how close you were. And once I got to know him, I understood why you held him in such high regard." He went on and on and on, telling me what he thought I wanted to hear. And then he passed me off to Hillary. And I said, "Mrs. Clinton, I'm Roger Stone." She looked at me and said, "Yes, I know who you are." Then my wife, who was behind me in the receiving line, she shakes Clinton's hand, and Clinton looks at her, winks, and says, "If you're ever in Washington, honey, look me up."
Yeah, that's right.
This guy would pick up a woman at a funeral. That's what a hound dog he is. That's what a pervert he is.
Roger. Well, Hillary might have done the same.
She might have, but I'm not going to go there, as they say.
Well, you know, Bill has said on more than one occasion that Hillary's had more women than he has. He put it in a more colorful language, Roger. I'm sure you're familiar with the quote.
Yes, yeah, he told that to Jennifer Flowers, and it's in her book. But it's very interesting. The other night when I was on with Sean Hannity, they played a tape of him when Hillary was running for the Senate, and Bill said, "Well, Hillary's less comfortable with homosexuality than I am. She has a more strict and kind of religious upbringing. I'm somewhat more cosmopolitan. I've known more gay people than she has. She may not be as comfortable with it as I am." Of course, gays are a very important constituency in New York State, particularly for a Democrat. I have many gay friends. I'm not in any way a homophobe. But this was all positioning, because contrast that with Bill telling Jennifer Flowers Hillary's been with more women than he has. So it's just another example of the Clintons lying. These people lie as easy as you and I get out of bed.
Yeah, Hillary's clearly bisexual. My impression is Bill's straight. He's just extremely aggressive about it.
Yeah, well, but my book is not about consensual sex. Jim, if I wrote a book about consensual sex and Bill Clinton, about every mistress, girlfriend, one-night stand, it'd be five volumes.
Sure would.
You'd be able to use them for doorstops.
Yeah.
I focused on non-consensual sex. Look, I'm a libertine. I think consensual relations between adults is their business, as distasteful as that may be. But rape or sex with underage girls, children,
that's
a line which Bill Clinton has crossed, and Hillary Clinton knows he's crossed it. And still, they are on a quest for power.
Wilt Chamberlain boasted of having 20,000 women. I suppose Bill could be somewhere not that far behind.
Oh, I bet that Bill Clinton leaves Wilt in the dust. Now, Wilt,
really?
People don't know this, but Wilt was a strong supporter of Richard Nixon's. And they actually met at Dr. King's funeral. Now, in 1968, when Dr. King was assassinated, and by the way, he wasn't killed by James Earl Ray, as we know, Nixon and his advisors really debated whether Nixon should go to the funeral. There was one camp headed by John Mitchell who were looking at the transformation of white Southern Democrats into the Republican Party and thought showing up at the King funeral could cost them electoral votes in the South. There were others who said, "Well, wait a minute, you've had a warm relationship with King. It was Nixon who rounded up the Republican votes to pass the 1958 Civil Rights Act. He and King were friends. King wrote him a very warm letter, which I have seen, giving Nixon due credit for passing the 58 Civil Rights Bill when good old Lyndon Johnson, that great supporter of civil rights, did everything humanly possible to stop that bill." And Nixon elected to go. But he told his body man, in this case his driver, Nick Rui, "Look, Nick, I'm going to go to the service. I'm going to sit in the back of the church. But when the service breaks up, I am not marching to the cemetery with Eugene McCarthy and Bobby Kennedy and Jackie and all these left wingers. I'm not doing it. So when the service is over, I will go to the side door, have the car waiting for me, take me back to the airport. I paid my respects. I've been seen at the funeral." He had already gone to the home and paid his respects privately to
Coretta Scott King. Yeah.
So the funeral is over. Everybody stands up. They're all starting to jostle towards the door. And suddenly Nixon feels an enormous black hand on his shoulder. And he looks up. And 7 feet tall, Wilt Chamberlain says, "Are you ready to march, Mr. Nixon?" Nixon says, "March, yes. Why, well, of course, yes, we'll march." And Nixon goes out behind the funeral procession, and he and Chamberlain start marching behind the crowd. Bobby is there, and Eugene McCarthy, and Dr. Spock, and all these crazy left-wingers. And Rui doesn't know what's going on. He is back in the car. Nixon doesn't come out the side door. So he starts idling and following the procession one block over. And he can see Nixon marching. And, of course, Nixon's told him 9 times now, "Riddick, Nick, I don't march. I'm not marching." So he's perplexed. Nixon keeps looking at his watch, keeps looking over at the car, looking at his watch. The march is going forward. And finally, Nixon says, "Well, to be honest with you, they're holding a plane for me. I've got to get back to New York." And Chamberlain says, "Mr. Nixon, do you mind if I catch a ride?" Whereupon they both jump in Nixon's car. They're whisked to the airport. On the way back to New York, they both get roaring drunk. And by the time they landed, Wilt Chamberlain was now a paid consultant to the Nixon campaign for president.
I love it.
And Nick Rui told me that he worked his way through every campaign secretary, every stewardess, and then they had to go into volunteers. And once they ran out of volunteers, Rui's job was to go out and hire hookers. Wilt was insatiable.
Oh, fascinating, fascinating.
Now, if you read Pat Buchanan's recent book on the comeback, he says that Nixon went to the funeral, but he declined to march. So I make this case not because I don't like Buchanan, but because my book is much more accurate and somewhat more colorful.
Well, I think Buchanan is pretty much a truth teller, Roger. I mean, it seems to me when you compare him with the average, he's head and shoulders. You are well above him, but I think Buchanan actually makes a lot of astute and very accurate observations about the political scene.
Well, Pat's a friend of mine. He has been for over 30 years. However, for whatever reason, he does not want to know the true narrative of Richard Nixon and the Kennedy assassination.
Yeah.
Just doesn't want to know it.
Yeah.
And I sent him my book on Johnson. I got a warm note back. I sent him my book on Nixon, and he didn't want to hear about it. And he thinks the idea that Nixon went to the Murchison home on the 22nd is ludicrous. But Charles McWhorter, who was Nixon's longtime scheduler from the 50s on, showed me the written schedule for Nixon on the day before and the day of. And it shows two things. It shows a private meeting. It doesn't say with whom, at the Adolphus Hotel for 2 hours. That's when he meets with Lyndon Johnson. And it shows him at the Murchison Ranch, but at 7 o'clock in the evening. That is consistent with what Jim Tague says, which was there was a cocktail party earlier in the evening honoring Hoover. It was bipartisan because, by the way, Bruce Alger was there. I confirmed that before his death. And then there is the meeting much later, which is John Carrington, the lawyer for H.L. Hunt, Ed Clark, Lyndon Johnson, as you know, the plotters, the people you outlined earlier. I have my doubts that Nixon was at the later meeting. I think he was being handled. He'd been sucked in and he was being handled. But because he has no power in 1963, I don't know that he's in the inner circle because they don't need him for anything other than to sell him the cover story. By the way, that's why when he gets to his apartment in New York and the doorman tells him that Kennedy is dead, he learns in the cab that Kennedy's been shot. On his way home from the airport, he flies from Dallas to what is then Idlewild Airport. He jumps in a cab. He learns in the car that Kennedy has been shot. He doesn't learn that he's dead until he gets to his apartment house. He goes to his apartment. He calls Hoover and he says, "Edgar, was it one of those right wingers?" Because that's what they wanted him to believe. And what does Hoover say? "No, Dick, it was the communist." Kennedy's been dead for less than half an hour, but Hoover already knows it's a communist.
That's right. It's all a stunning story, Roger. You're just a source of encyclopedic information. These Clinton people, it seems to me, the Republicans are doing everything but giving the election to Hillary by, number one, revealing that the whole Benghazi probe was to drive down her poll numbers, had nothing to do with the truth. And number two, by their relentless assault on women's reproductive rights, 52% of the American voting public is women, Roger, and they're going to overwhelmingly reject Republicans on this ground alone and support Hillary.
Well, I think the country's in such rough shape that, frankly, some of those issues might be transcended. I would have to argue, by the way, that just because Kevin McCarthy's an idiot doesn't mean everybody on that committee's an idiot. He blurted out a political truth, which is the net results of these hearings have damaged, and her lying about Benghazi have damaged her political standing. But this is really simple. And as I say in my book, the whole idea that the attack on our mission was caused by an anti-Islamic video that was shown one time on the internet in Turkey, where, by the way, nobody is on the internet, was invented by Sidney Blumenthal. It's in a memo, one of the memos that Hillary tried to erase. This is a canard. It's a cover story.
Sure.
And it's a cover story because they did not want to admit in the weeks before a presidential election that American interests had been attacked abroad and four Americans had died at the hands of a group that was affiliated with Al-Qaeda. That was political dynamite.
Watching
cover that up.
Watching about an hour and a half of the hearing this morning, I'll say, I mean, one of the members of the panel observed they had $40 million to finance this investigation. That's 10 times what was allocated for 9/11. It's the longest running investigation by a special committee in the history of the Congress, exceeding both 9/11 and the Warren Commission investigation many times over. I mean, it's really outrageous when, look, whatever the truth may be, Kevin McCarthy gave Hillary a get out of jail free card, and Hillary sitting there completely in possession of herself, completely calm, completely relaxed, dispatching one verbal assault after another. She's convincing the American people, Roger, even as you and I here sit speaking today, that she is highly qualified to be the president of the United States.
Well, as you know, sociopaths are able to lie with a straight face.
It's one
of their great qualities.
Yes. Well, I'm not saying she's the right guy. I like you, I'm a huge favor of Donald Trump myself. I'm just saying Hillary is looking very presidential, and the Republicans are putting a mantle. You know, they're giving her the bouquet of roses, frankly. This is all backfiring.
Well, I would have to say, as someone who has a long sentimental attachment to the Republican Party, I was the Young Republican National Chairman in my youth, 1977 to 79. I worked for three Republican presidents. I worked as a special assistant to Senator Bob Dole. And I am in many ways heartbroken about leaving the party. But my point is this. Never underestimate the stupidity of the Republican Party, ever.
Yes, yes, yes.
It's the stupid party.
Let me ask you this, Roger. It seems to me the recent resurgence where the Republicans won a whole host of seats they were expected to lose has been largely generated by electronic voting machines that are owned by and supported by those whose loyalty lies to the Republican Party. In the election in Ohio, for example, the owner of the voting company said he was going to do everything he could to ensure that that Bush and Cheney were reelected. And I have no doubt he did. In fact, there's a book by a fellow named Bob Petrakis, who's a friend of mine. He's a professor. He's an attorney from Columbus who is going to depose Mitch Connell, who was, of course, the Republican IT guy when he flew back into Columbus and then died in a mysterious plane crash, where he'd learned about the basement operation in Chattanooga, Tennessee, where the Ohio raw vote was being sent there for Karl Rove to massage the numbers before he sent it back for Kent Blackwell, who was both the Secretary of State for Ohio and the Bush-Cheney co-chairman of the Bush-Cheney reelection committee to announce them. I mean, the theft using electronic voting machines is just so blatant and so obvious. How can we put an end to it?
Yeah, my friend Richard Charnin has written several excellent books on this case. By the way, this also explains why Karl Rove insists on Fox News that Romney is going to carry Ohio. No, no, you're wrong. These numbers have to be wrong because he thought the fix was in.
Yes.
And it wasn't. By the way, this is no different than the old-fashioned vote stealing by LBJ. The only difference is they used to do it by hand now.
Well, you mentioned Richard Charnin. He and I co-authored an article about Scott Walker's meteoric rise and how he prevailed in a recall election, unlike the two other governors who preceded him. I was among the hundreds of thousands who went down to protest at the Capitol, Roger. No, he could not have survived that legitimately. His victory over a very good woman Democrat candidate after Michelle Obama came here twice, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, we had an historic turnout, which, as you well know, favors Democrats. It turns out in Milwaukee County, the larger the number of votes cast, the larger the percentage that went to Scott Walker. If you simply inverted the ratio, it was like 53 to 47, you would have had the ratio by which Mary Burke legitimately meets Scott Walker, but they flipped the numbers, Roger. I'm telling you, that's what happened here. And Charnin and I published an article about it entitled Voter Fraud versus Election Theft, Wisconsin Scott Walker Re-election.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the article, and Richard is a good friend of mine. I'm not an expert, obviously, on Wisconsin. I would say this. I know Ken Blackwell, the Secretary of State in Ohio. I've known him for 30 years, 20 years. He's so dumb he couldn't draw a bath. So it is clear to me that someone was orchestrating this. And, yes, I think Rove is the chief perp. But let's not pretend that election manipulation is done by one party, because it's not. There is only one party. It's the Green Party. It's run by money. And the Clintons and the Bushes are both in it. It's both Republicans and Democrats. The best example of this, 3 years ago, I helped get Governor Gary Johnson, the two-term governor of New Mexico, on the ballot in 48 states as the Libertarian Party candidate. That is a phenomenal accomplishment, because the rules to get on the ballot in the 50 states are written by Republicans and Democrats working together. And their greatest desire isn't to put people on the ballot as independents or third-party candidates. It's to keep them off. This is not about giving the voters more choices. It's about limiting their choices. The Presidential Commission on Debates is not appointed by the president. It is not a commission, and it's not about debates. It's a for-profit organization run by the Republicans and the Democrats. The co-chairs of that are the Republican National Chairman and the Democratic National Chairman. To me, if you can get on the ballot in 48 states and therefore theoretically win 270 electoral votes, you ought to be allowed in the debates. What would have happened if people had known that there was a third choice? 70% of the people told us in polls 68, 69 that they were unhappy with the choice between Obama and Romney. And they just lamented the fact that there was no other choice. Of course, there was another choice. There was a candidate who wanted to end the war in Afghanistan immediately. There was a candidate who wanted to completely repeal the Patriot Act. There was a candidate who was against the NDAA. There was a candidate who wanted to legalize and tax marijuana. There was a candidate who favored deep spending cuts and tax cuts. And that candidate couldn't get any traction because nobody knew he was running. And the media staged a blackout. Most people still don't know he was even a candidate. By the way, a very accomplished and successful governor of New Mexico. He had a record in terms of job creation, cut spending, cut taxes, cut regulation, yet had an economic boom in that state. Created more jobs than Governor Rick Perry and Governor Mitt Romney and Governor Scott Walker put together. Yet he couldn't get the time of day out of the national media. So it shows once again how the system is rigged against the average man, and it's rigged against any insurgent. It's rigged against any third force. By the way, it's even harder to get on the ballot as an independent than it is to get on the ballot as a third party candidate. At least a third party candidate, in the case of the Libertarians, think you start with 25 ballots automatically. I've tried to talk my friend Jesse Ventura into running because, like Donald Trump, he's fearless. And I hope he'll consider it, particularly if Donald is not nominated, because the choice between Jeb Bush and Hillary Clinton is no choice whatsoever.
Dismal, dismal, dismal. Now, it seems to me that there are several steps that need to be done if the American people are to regain control of their political destiny. The first is getting rid of the electronic voting machines, which, you know, they're all biased in terms of Republicans, Roger. Whatever you may want to say, it's clear the record, the ownership, the outcomes have all favored Republicans. Number two, We got to get rid of these gerrymandered districts that enable a representative in the state legislature, for example, to be elected again and again and again with virtual no competition. And we got to get money, big money, out of federal elections. I favor all federal elections being publicly financed. Fourth, and it sounds extraordinary, but I think it's actually indispensable, we need to restore the draft. Well, once Nixon abolished the draft, it took the anti-war pressure off of him, Roger, as you well know. But the fact is, it made most American families no longer concerned about issues of war and peace. Let the executive do it. Let someone else fight it. Their sons and daughters aren't going to be involved anyway. I think it's been calamitous for the nation.
Well, I would argue that a major factor in Nixon's downfall is that the hardliners thought that he was going to continue the war. In fact, they finally thought they'd be unfettered, which when you consider how much bombing Johnson did really says something. They thought Nixon was the ultimate hawk. Lo and behold, he ends the war over the objection of his defense secretary. He speeds up the withdrawal of American troops. He reaches a SALT agreement with the Soviets. He opens the door to China. These things are anathema to the Pentagon. They're anathema to the military-industrial complex. God knows. We thought we had the ultimate hawk, and Nixon turns out to be a peacemaker. This is a major factor. It's why the military, under Admiral Thomas Moore, begins spying on Nixon. As you probably know, a young ensign named Radford at night, who's a military attaché in the White House, is going through Kissinger's briefcase, going through Kissinger's desk, going through the desks of a number of Nixon aides, copying documents at the direction of Al Haig, I might add, and spiriting them out to the Joint Chiefs. Nixon, when he learns about this, he says it's treasonous, which it is. And John Mitchell talks him out of rocking the boat. He wanted to fire Moore. And in the end, he didn't. But it is the beginning of the seeds of Watergate. The military-industrial complex is apoplectic because Nixon and Kissinger negotiate the opening to China around our diplomatic process. The same way, by the way, JFK had reached out to Castro through intermediaries, not going through the regular channels so that the CIA and the Pentagon wouldn't know. He authorizes his college roommate in Princeton, who's a diplomat, to reach out to Castro. He has Jacqueline Kennedy go to a French journalist who is a friend of hers, who he knows is a friend of Castro's, to send Castro the message that he wants to talk. And Castro, who is surprised, sends back the message that he's willing. So the idea that the Russians or the Cubans killed Kennedy, an idea that Johnson pushed constantly, is false. Khrushchev has no motive. He had just taken Kennedy to the cleaners in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Our missiles were never removed. His agreement with Castro doesn't even call for on-site inspections. We removed our missiles from Europe. That was a secret for 40 years.
Turkey
and Italy. And additionally, Castro has just had a peace feeler from JFK, and he is reported to be intrigued. So I think at the time of Kennedy's murder, neither one has a particular motive. Look at the motives of those involved, the agency, the mob, Big Texas Oil, and then the point man, the drum major, if you will, the man leading the parade. That would be LBJ.
Well, you know, he told Jack time and time again that the civil rights bill wasn't timely. And of course,
too soon.
Yeah, he meant it wasn't timely because he wanted to take credit for it when he was president. So he held off until he could use all the country's sentiment for the Warren president to help support this legislation through Congress, for which he would then take credit.
No question. It's also interesting, if you saw the movie Selma, and if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. It is exactly right. Lyndon Johnson did not want a Voting Rights Act in 1965. He was forced into it by King. King goes to Johnson and says he wants it to be a legislative priority, and Johnson says, no, I got a whole country to worry about. It's going to have to wait. And King won't take that for an answer. So he stages the Selma march, knowing that there'll be violence, because he wants to force Johnson's hand. Johnson tells Andrew Young, an aide to King, that King is, quote, a crazy nigger preacher who thinks he's running this country. Joe Califano writes, in retrospect, the Selma March was LBJ's idea, and that he and King had a partnership in civil rights. It's total nonsense. The Selma movie has it exactly right. But even today, reaching from the grave, the Johnsonites who are still in Hollywood, those who are still influential, the Bill Moyers of our day, they made sure that this courageous director, Ava DuVernay, did not get an Oscar, for which she deserved an Oscar. So if you haven't seen the film, I highly recommend it. Phil Nelson and I have written on this extensively for Breitbart and also for Town Hall. Lyndon Johnson was opposed to the 1965 Act. He was outmaneuvered by Martin Luther King into doing it, into passing it. And only then does he go to the floor of Congress with his impassioned plea for civil rights. He was a lifelong segregationist. You're exactly right. He kept telling Kennedy the time wasn't right. You'll offend the old bulls in the Senate. You won't get any of your appropriations, any of your defense appropriations. He was reserving that opportunity for himself.
Justice Jack Valenti, who had been one of Lyndon's closest aides, subverted Oliver Stone's prospects to win the best picture for JFK, which it so richly deserved, by working behind the scenes to sabotage it. And then, of course, the Academy Award goes instead to a film about a sadistic cannibal titled Silence of the Lambs. What a miscarriage of justice.
Well, as you may know, Valente is really, he is fronting really as a beard. He's married to Johnson's mistress. Jack Valente's daughter, Courtney Valente, is the daughter of Lyndon Baines Johnson and Valente's wife. I knew Jack very well. Jack was a swordsman. Jax may have been a bisexual swordsman. But he was not having sex with his wife. His wife was the mistress of LBJ.
And Lyndon, of course, had many.
At one time, he impregnated four women simultaneously who were in the White House aerial pool.
Isn't that amazing, Roger? Oh, God. Well, listen, I mean, do those steps I proposed, you endorse them? The electronic voting machines, the gerrymandering, getting a private money out, restoring the draft. Would you endorse any of those or a combination?
I would disagree with you on a couple of them. The voting machines, I think, can go, but I also think as the country has moved into technology, anyone who comes out and says we should have paper ballots is going to be considered a Luddite. So I think it's a political impossibility. And by the way, as LBJ proved, they can screw with the paper ballots too. It's just not that hard. Secondarily, no, I'm for Citizens United. You know why? I could never raise the money to take Kathy Willey and Juanita Broderick and 10 other women I'm not ready to name and put them on the air. I could never find the money to do that as I intend to do next year. So don't assume that Hillary's going to get a walk, because I will put Kathy Willey on a plane and she's going to show up wherever Hillary shows up with her own press secretary and her own press operation. But more importantly, we're going to cut 30 and 60 second spots, and they, by law, cannot keep us off the air. So I don't care whether CNN interviews these women. I will put them on in paid advertising.
Well, I think that's sensational, Roger. Give me your short-term prognostication on the Democratic side. Do you think Bernie Sanders has a chance? Is there anyone else who could possibly derail Hillary? You're suggesting she may undo herself because of her past misdeeds.
Well, I still think that the only person who hates her more than I do, and I do hate her because of her psychopathic abuse of people. So people say, oh, Stone and Morrow, you guys are just haters. If you read what the Clintons have done to people, men, women, and children, they're worthy of hatred. That's number one. Number two, the energy in that party is on the progressive left. It's not in the center. Joe Biden would never have beaten her anyway. I'm just as glad he didn't run. He appeals to the same people she appeals to, union bosses and Democratic Party regulars. He has no appeal to voters. Last two times he ran for president, he couldn't get out of single digits. But the one person who despises her more than we do is Barack Hussein Obama and his right hand, Sancho Panza, Valerie Jarrett. They do not want Hillary to succeed him. And the president of the United States has awesome powers. So, again, this isn't over until it's over.
What's the source of the antagonism there between Barack and Hillary?
Well, I think when they ran against each other, the Obama people know that it was Sidney Blumenthal who was spreading the word that Barack Obama was a homosexual. That's exactly why, once Obama was elected, Rahm Emanuel told the Clintons, Sidney Blumenthal will never be on the federal payroll in this administration. No, you cannot hire him at the State Department. The reason this is significant is Hillary was allowed to hire anyone she wanted, and she surrounded herself, as you might imagine, with Clinton loyalists, all of whom had opposed Obama's election. There was only one person who was banned, unilaterally banned, and that was Sidney Blumenthal, because Blumenthal had been the one both spreading the word that Clinton was the son of Frank Marshall Davis, the communist, and separately that Barack Obama was secretly gay. And Obama knows this. Also, I believe Ed Klein, whose book Unlikable is out, concurrent with mine. Hillary went not that many months ago to see Barack Obama, asked for a private appointment. He put her off for a number of weeks, which aggravated her. Finally, Valerie Jarrett convinced the president that he had to see her. When she showed up in the Oval Office, Jarrett was there. And she said, I wanted to see you privately. And the president said, well, you don't get to decide who's in my meetings. Valerie stays. What do you want? And she said, I'm very upset about this whole email server thing. I think that the leaks are coming out of your White House, Mr. President. And he looked at Jarrett, then he looked at her, and he said, we don't know anything about it. And she said, call off your effing dogs, Barack. And he looked out the window for a long time, according to Klein, and this could only have come from Jarrett. And he finally turned to her and he said, you've made all your own problems. This meeting is over. I still think that she will not be president. And I think the person who has more power to stop her and the guy who has the ability to draft another candidate is Barack Obama. I also think, as savvy as he is, Barack Obama knew that Joe Biden would be a terrible candidate. By the way, Joe Biden's nothing like his public image. I would draw your attention to a terrific story, really a piece of a book that was serialized by the New York Post 2 weekends ago about how abusive he is to his staff. A person who abuses the people who work for him or her, to me, that tells you a lot, even in the media world.
Well, if Hillary is taken out by some combination of factors to which you're alluding, can Bernie Sanders emerge as a Democratic nominee?
I suspect they'll prop up somebody else who's more serviceable. Bernie Sanders is almost 70 years old, and he's a socialist. The country is not going to elect a socialist. I'm sorry, but an 85% tax rate's not going to work for working people. Just not going to work. Government is not the answer.
Let's look at the Republican side. It seems to me you have quite a few losers there who can't draw even 3%. I mean, even Rand Paul, who before this all began, I thought was a significant candidate. It seemed to me he shot himself in the foot when he opposed the Iran nuclear deal, which where supporting it would have been consistent with his non-interventionist foreign policy. From that point on, I began having very serious doubts about Rand Paul. I'm very enthusiastic about Trump for all kinds of reasons. Can he sustain it? Can he keep going? Can he move forward? He's not going to run out of money.
I agree with you about the rest of them being losers. There's not a winner in that pack with the exception of Trump. He has the money. He has the courage. He has the commitment. And I think if he survives what I think is going to be an extraordinary assault from Wall Street early next year, intimates of mine who are well connected tell me that they intend to try to bury him in a $35 to $40 million negative advertising blitz imminently, maybe as soon as next month, no later than January. Now, that will be the juncture at which Trump is going to have to reach into his own pocket and spend, something that he hasn't had to do so far. What's interesting to me, I've been in this business a long time. I'm a veteran of 9 presidential candidates. I've worked for 3 presidents. You can't run on free media alone. That's kind of an axiom, but he has very successfully. And he has finished the prospects of Jeb Bush. Jeb Bush was supposed to be coronated. He was supposed to march right in like his brother and his father. And he's in sixth place in Iowa now at 6% of the vote. And nobody will ever look at this guy and not think that he's low energy, because he is. So if Trump has accomplished nothing else, he has sidelined the House of Bush from having another president. He's perfectly capable of winning this nomination. He's got the money and he's got the courage. And I'm hopeful that he will do so. Rand Paul, in all honesty, I'm sympathetic to a number of his positions. I must tell you, on a lot of things, I disagree with Trump. But on the one most important thing, we don't disagree. I think he's independent. I don't think he's controlled by Wall Street. I don't think he's controlled by the duopoly.
I think he does stand for integrity in government.
Well, and in all honesty, he thinks the war on drugs is a great thing. I think the war on drugs has been an expensive, abysmal failure.
It's been a way of boosting the profits of the CIA to become the biggest drug dealer in the world.
Exactly. So we disagree on some things. But the problem with Rand Paul, in all honesty, is there's no constituency for what he's selling in the Republican Party. It's very limited. The neocons are still in the ascendancy in the Republican Party. And therefore, his candidacy has fizzled. By the way, he might have done better if he bought a good suit and got a haircut, and got a shirt that fit him. But that's a different question.
Where did this Carly Fiorina come from? She seems to me an oddity by any yardstick.
She's a ringer. I mean, the idea that she's an outsider is absurd. She was the chief domestic policy advisor for John McCain. And John McCain is the ultimate insider. You know, people said when Trump attacked McCain, the Republicans I know, the regulars said, oh, that's it. He's done. Talk to any POW family in the country. They despise John McCain.
Yes.
Because he and John Kerry got out, and then they closed the door behind them and they sealed all the records. Sidney Shanberg wrote a piece that I believe won an award for the New York Times on the cover-up of our POW catastrophe. And the chief cover-uppers were John McCain and John Kerry. He's been on the Veterans Affairs Committee for 30 years. Jim, 1,000 veterans died last year waiting for medical care.
And it's outrageous, Roger, outrageous.
And those deaths were swept under the counter. And like Benghazi, nobody is being held responsible. And the two guys who sponsored that legislation, John McCain and Bernie Sanders.
When McCain was running for president, I published an article entitled John McCain Physically, Mentally, and Morally Corrupt. I mean, he's absolutely nothing. He's got nothing to offer the country in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, he was also, as I said, very much like Bush. He was the designated loser. His job was to go lose. You remember his campaign. He went around the country praising Obama, a great senator, a great public servant. That's not how politics works. You don't beat the other guy by not challenging him.
Where did Ben Carson come from, Roger?
Excellent question. I can't figure it out. I also can't figure out what his appeal is. I understand these new poll numbers are so good, Ben almost opened his eyes.
It's strange. It's very strange. He denies evolution. He's got very strange views. He's asserted a Muslim could not serve in violation of the Sixth Amendment. Now he's trying to save ground by claiming it's Sharia law that he was opposing, that we can't have Sharia law under the Constitution, which that doesn't get any argument. That's trying to save his own face for a remark that was a blunder.
Yeah, I don't understand his appeal. I mean, look, in Donald Trump's case, you can sum this up. What does he want to do? He wants to make America great again. I just said it in a sentence. What is Ben Carson running on? What is he running on? He's a Seventh-day Adventist. He only became a Christian within the last couple years. He has got a slew of medical malpractice suits following him around. You saw where he left a sponge in one of his patients. I don't understand the appeal. I'm just not seeing it. We shall see whether he fizzles. This rise in the polls, it's very important to understand. Ben has spent $30 million. He spent 10 of it in Iowa. He's on television. Nobody else is on television. Television advertising works. It has always worked. And it works particularly well when you are up alone, when you're not competing with other people. So he's running in the clear, as we say in the business, and he's running up the numbers. I believe it will be temporary. Any impression that is created quickly also recedes quickly. So public figures you've known for a long time. Reagan, for example, was on the national scene for 40 years. He was a known commodity. Everybody knew who Ronald Reagan was, and he was. People said, oh, he's a conservative. He's a conservative. He was a Goldwater man. He's a conservative. A year ago, nobody knew who Ben Carson was. A year from now, nobody will know who Ben Carson is. So I don't think anything here is permanent. This race is wide open. What's interesting to me, of course, is that all the same people who said to me a year ago, your friend Trump will never run. He'll never run. This is just a tease. This is about branding. This is about improving his public image. Then they said, okay, Trump got in, but he'll never file his financial disclosures. He'll never tell people how much he's really worth and where it's based on. Yet in the end, it was Trump who filed his financial disclosure on time, and it was Jeb who had to ask for 3 extensions. Now they say, oh, he, you know, okay, so he's had a pretty good run, but once he gets into these debates, he's going to crash and burn, and that'll be it. So he's now been in two debates, and after both debates, his numbers in the polls went up. So then they said to me, okay, this is just a summer dalliance. The voters will get more serious in the fall, and they'll start looking more closely. And what's happening? The summer of Trump is turning into the autumn of Trump. Pretty soon it'll be the winter of Trump. No, Jim, he can win. It's all up to him.
Well, I think it's sensational, and I've been tremendously impressed with him, and he's doing so much good by exposing the corruption of the status quo about politics as usual that I think the American people find him inspiring, Roger, absolutely inspiring. And Jeb Bush is just a pathetic wimp. He's not only low energy, where Trump has made that very clear, but he doesn't seem to have any dedication or determination. He's not all that smart. He's a very gross disappointment. And I'm very pleased to hear you're going to have a book about Jeb that exposes the whole family. That, to me, is wonderful news, Roger.
Well, actually, I have just won an epic battle with my publisher, and it is now finally listed on Amazon. It's called Jeb and the Bush Crime Family. You can pre-order it today. Just a little preview, you know, I really go into Jeb's background as a drug dealer. He was dealing drugs in prep school. He was dealing drugs in high school. He was dealing drugs, in a college. He was dealing drugs in Houston after he got out of college. He was dealing drugs when he first came to Miami in the 80s. The lawyers at my publisher went completely insane when I wrote this. But after I produced the documentation, they had to back off. It's all in the book. This guy has been in one shady business deal after another. Five of his partners from five different business endeavors are in prison, even as we speak. Jeb likes to say he's a businessman. Jim, he's a fixer. He's lived by using the Bush family name. He gets carried interests in these various deals because of his name. Then he lobbies officials in Washington. So let me put it to another way. He's made money on Obamacare. Obama phones, he and Carlos Slim are the partners in the telecom company that has the federal contract to supply phones to the federal government. Carlos Slim owns the New York Times. This has never appeared in print anyplace. Now, if you go to Jeb's financial disclosure forms, there's no stock in the company's name is TracFone. There's no TracFone on his financial disclosure. That's because I learned this from a notary public. The week before he filed his financial disclosure, he transferred that stock to his son. And I would not know that, but they went to a notary public to sign the documents, who is an active Cuban-American Republican, and she happened to keep a copy of those transfer documents. So he's a fraud and a criminal, just like his father, just like his grandfather, just like his mother's father. And I lay out the entire arc of crime by the Bush crime family in this upcoming book.
Well, this is sensational, Roger. He may be a fraud, but you're the real deal. I'd very much like to have you back in a month or two to go over the Jeb and the where things stand then. I hope you can join me again, Roger. Meanwhile, this has just been sensational. I don't know when I've had an interview that I've enjoyed so much.
Let me say one thing in closing, Jim. If a few weeks from now they tell you that I was depressed and I committed suicide, or if they tell you that I was killed in a hunting accident, or that I was killed in a freak accident and hit by a truck, you will know I was murdered by the Clintons.
I wish I could say it would be the first time, Roger, but I am on your side all the way, my friend, and I'm going to do all I can to make sure that your views are widely promulgated. You're doing a brilliant job. I can't thank you enough for coming on the show. This is Jim Fetzer thanking my special guest, Roger Stone, for being here, and all of you for listening.